Oh, I've stood on a D4.
Dirk's dossier.
Hello, my name is Dirk the Dice, and this is my dossier, an extra page that's fallen out of the Grognard files and picked up off the floor of the den for your ears only. I tried to keep the main episodes of the Grognard files within 90 minutes, which means that there are often chunks of stuff that gets cut out. These little dossiers allow the bits to be spliced together, like those DVD extras that we used to get excited about at the end of the 90s before we realised that they weren't worth bothering about. But don't let that put you off. This little bit extra is occasionally available for patrons. It's a bit more rough and ready, knocked together out of offcuts and framed by bits of me talking to myself, editorialising about things that are concerning me at the moment. I'm putting this on the main feed as a seasonal gift, if you want it or not. You know, like that U2 album that Apple gave us all. Now, I'm a big Springsteen fan. I know I don't like to bang on about it. And at the time of recording, I've just finished the book Deliver Me From Nowhere by journalist and musician Warren Zanes. It was the basis of the recent biopic that's been in cinemas with Jeremy Allen White playing the boss as he retreats into himself to produce Nebraska, his most introspective album. The demo recordings he made in his rental room ended up being used rather than being re-recorded in the studio with the band. Jeremy Strong plays John Landau, his manager-producer, who said of Nebraska, "This is the sound of Bruce singing to himself, for himself." Springsteen paraphrases Scorsese in Zane's book as he says, "We do this thing in the hope that audiences will connect and share our obsessions." These dossier podcasts, this is me talking to myself and hoping that you share the same gaming obsessions. Am I comparing Dirk's dossier to Nebraska? Arguably Springsteen's most influential work? Yes, that's what I'm doing. I'm comparing this Bobbins to Nebraska. What's in this one? Well, there's Blythe talking about a new game that he played at Owlbear and the Wizard Staff Convention. If you've listened to the episode, you'll know that we spoke at some length about the Hidden Isle RPG that he played there. We'll come back to that in the next episode, as I've had a chance to play it now. But here he talks a bit about Into the Dungeon Revived, a variant of Into the Odd. The main body of this contains some more gladiator chat. We took some inspiration from Graham Bottley's Savage Worlds Gladiator supplement. Graham talked to me about how the project was developed and worked through some of the mechanical innovations that he included. There's a discussion between me and Blythe after a couple of games of the Gladiator campaign, followed by a brief reflection from me about the roses and thorns of the exercise, what went well and the bits that didn't quite work out. The last section has more from the interview with Magnus Seta, which was really well received, talking about his book Outside the Box, his fan history of RPGs in Sweden. In this part, he talks about his writing career in role-playing. I'll be back at the end with some words of encouragement, but until then, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Blythe talking, Bobbins!
I played another new game. It's not quite new. It's a variation of Into the Odd. And I played that at Albert with Neil, old Scouser. And it was called Into the Dungeon Revived. Into the Dungeon Revived. And it was basically, it was Into the Odd. It's based on Into the Odd, but it has more of a kind of fantasy feel to a few extra rules about weapons and magic and things like that. And that was very, I really enjoyed it, actually. It was kind of interesting. I don't think I've ever played an Into the Odd game. I've always run them.
Yeah.
But it worked very well because it did that thing, the famous into the odd mechanic of you don't roll to hit, you just roll the damage.
Yes.
That kind of thing. And you can get better dice by having advantages, and if it's impaired, you get a worse dice, things like that. And that mechanic actually worked very, very well. And we got through it. Not sure if Neil was happy because we all survived.
Oh, right.
On record, I've played in a Neil Benson game where everybody survived.
Yeah.
It's at his damnedest to kill some of us, but we all managed to somehow pull through.
It's going
to
damage your brass.
Not play that again, really. I'll not run that again. But it was a lot of fun, though. It was good. It was good kind of old school kind of fantasy adventure. But that into the odd mechanic, it made things move along a bit quicker.
Yeah.
You know, it was more pacey. We got more done. It was interesting to think we got more done in that adventure than we would have done if you'd run Old School Essentials or D&D or something like that, because you don't have that problem of keep missing, hit, miss, 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 hit.
Yeah.
You don't get that. The fights last two or three rounds, and they're quite tense because you think, that monster is going to hit me this round. If I don't do something about it, he's going to do that D10 damage to somebody.
Yes.
So it was quite exciting. Quite simple. It's a simple concept. It's quite exciting. Because I've run into the odd games, and I've sometimes wondered, is this working for the players? Is this mechanic work? But having now experienced it as a player, I think it really does, because as a player, it's quite exciting.
Yeah.
Knowing that it's not going to miss.
Yeah.
It's going to hit me. I just have to hope it rolls a one or a two and my armor takes it, but it will hit me this round. So I have to do something to either take it down or impair it in some way. Otherwise, I'm going to be dead pretty quick. And that added a lot of excitement to it.
I find it fascinating. I find it fascinating that Into the Odd is Chris's attempt to kind of strip it back to its core.
Yeah.
And everybody wants to add bells and whistles.
Add a few bits on. Yeah, it's true that. Yeah. But I think they didn't add that much on. But it added enough on. It had like character classes. So it was the same system, but it gave each character class a few abilities. And as a wizard, I played the wizard, obviously. The wizard had some spells which worked. It was that kind of thing that it added. It added a bit more flavour, I suppose, to each character. So, you know, you could just go, well, you're the ranger, so you can do some tracking and you're good with the book, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
That's, and those that kind of played into it. So it was still quite simple, but as I say, not entirely a new game, but I suppose a new twist on something.
Yeah.
Graham Buckley on Gladiators.
I think I was talking to you before we came on air about our current project. We've got our community started gladiatorial combat in an arena using your Savage Worlds adaptation.
Fantastic idea. The thing is, we started with Maelstrom. The number of role-playing books we were publishing started to spread out. I've always been one of those people where I tend to be the GM for our group, and I have been for 43 years, whatever it is. I will get these ideas. I'll be watching TV, reading a book, and I'll go, that's what I want to run. That's what I want to run. And my brain will say, right, what can we run it in? And I'll look on my shelves. And we moved a few months ago. Not all of my game books are out. But I've got shelf after shelf after shelf of different rule systems. And I look around and go, that one, yeah, but I don't like that bit. That one, that's not going to work. And invariably, I'll say, right, I'll write it. You know, I thought about running a vampire, werewolf, ghost type game after watching Being Human on TV. Looked at vampire and werewolf and so on, could not understand the rules for the life of me. So I thought, right, I'll write one. So I took the old face rip system for Marvel Superheroes, took the lower end of it, because that it was sort of open source, and said, right, supernatural game. And so I've written lots of games that I want to play. So the whole Savage Worlds line of books, and we've got several in that now, came about because back in 94, I read a novel by Stephen Hunt, who's a very well-known sort of steampunk author. And it was called For the Crown and the Dragon. And it was a pseudo-Napoleonic where you've got things called Dragon Browns. So these are the scum of the scum. And they're recruited to the army because they're criminals and they're going to be hung otherwise and so on. And they're used almost as disposables, infantry. But you've got sort of army battle mages, and you've got these strange inquisitors who are blind and their eyes are sealed over with skin, and they can sort of interrogate people. And then you've got steam tanks and so on. I thought, what a fantastic game setting that would be. And then never did anything with it from 94. And then a few years ago, I was searching through some boxes and I came across a copy of this novel. And I read it again and thought, what a fantastic idea for a game setting, blah, blah. But of course, the internet being what it is, I soon found that Stephen had a web page, a contact us button. So I contacted him and said, any chance of being able to do an RPG of it? And he said, yeah, brilliant. So I thought, right, I need a system. And I think what was key was also being a huge fan of the Sharp books by Bernard Cornwell. When you read Sharp, he charges into battle and three Frenchmen jump in the way and he cuts them down. And then he charges on and two more Frenchmen and he cuts those down. And then he gets to the evil lieutenant who he's going to fight. And then he has a long duel that takes 12 pages of text. And so I thought, what I need is I need a game with minion rules, but also has good rules for firearms, leaders, that sort of thing. And I did a bit of research and it kept coming back to Savage Worlds, because Savage Worlds has one of the best implementations of leader type characters in any RPG. It's obviously because it's built as a flexible RPG, it can be used in any sort of setting. So you've already got rules for black powder and magic and integrating all these. I thought, brilliant, let's go for that. So I contacted Pinnacle and said, you know, how do I become a licensed contributor and so on and so forth. And then I wrote it, published it, and I thought, this is a fantastic system. And then it just expanded out. So I did a book called Invasion, which is the old XCOM computer game, but Savage Worlds. And that is brilliant as a one-off game. Some of your players can't make it. Grab your characters, fight some aliens, you know, put it to bed for a few weeks. We also, and I'm just writing this at the moment, turned it into a war game. And Savage Worlds worked brilliantly as a war game. Absolutely fantastic. So over here, I've got some painted Normans, Saxons, Assyrians, Egyptian pharaoh chariot, etc. Because I'm just writing historical modern and sci-fi setting codex to expand that out. So we did all of these. And then because you've got an RPG with a war game system using the same rules, I then wrote a campaign, a 20-part campaign, where two of the parts are big tabletop battles. So you run your campaign, you then have your big battle, you then go back to running your campaign. And the Savage Gladiators came about because I was watching things like Spartacus. And I thought this would be a brilliant sessional RPG. So like Invasion, you can play it almost as a combat simulator rather than a full RPG. Of course, there's lots of ways people can play it. You could play it as loads of character building, then a bit of a battle in the arena, and then loads of character stuff and a bit in the arena. Or you can do bit in the arena, bit in the arena, bit in the arena, bit of tidying up in between sessions, arena, arena, arena. You can play it in different ways. And I thought, you know, if we're going to do a gladiators game, let's do it in Savage Worlds. Because say I did it in Advanced Fighting Fantasy, which is obviously a system I know well and I can publish in, you can have a gladiator with your skill and stamina and a weapon skill. Gladiator 1, you know, I've got some miniatures here, you know, sword and shield, is not actually that different from that gladiator with a sword and shield, other than in the way they fight. Now, yeah, I could create different talents, but they would have a different talent. There's not much to differentiate them. Whereas, of course, all the experience of writing for Savage Worlds means that you can have a gladiator who has things like level-headed. So this is an intelligence-based gladiator. So keep getting extra cards, which means they get more jokers, which means they can, you know, get that bonus and get more bennies. And then what they can actually do, rather than fight the opponent, keep taunting them. Maybe they fight as part of a pair. So they keep taunting and distracting and making them vulnerable. And then the muscle head whacks them. And so you can build a gladiator based around intelligence or speed or agility or brute strength or just, you know, bloody toughness. So they don't hit that hard, but it's impossible to put them down because they just keep going and going and going. And because you've got that option of building them in different ways, but you're still growing in that power level, so you can still sort of go towards the if you like, the season finale where, you know, they win in the arena in Rome and they're given their freedom and they ride off into the sunset with a big bag of money. Great. But you can also do it very much as this sort of sessional game, as you say, as a tournament. Each player can have their own stable of gladiators because there are healing and recovery rules. You know, Bobbius the gladiator might get badly injured and it's going to take him 2 months to recover. So actually you're going to have to bring in one of the younger ones and hope he survives. And if he does, fantastic, because then you've got another gladiator coming through.
Yeah, and you've also got some rules for base building the ludus, haven't you? So,
absolutely.
Yeah. No, we're going to have some great fun with it. We've thrown in some monsters into ours as well.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, even at the start of Gladiator, put the various ways you can do this. You can do full-on fantasy with a gladiator element. You can do full-on history. You can do fantasy-ish and so on. I mean, again, your game, personally, I prefer to keep things like magic. It's a very subtle magic.
Yeah.
So rather than flight, because obviously a gladiator that could fly poses a real problem because they get in the arena and they just fly away. Well, that doesn't entertain anyone. So I suspect the moment they realize that gladiator can fly, that gladiator gets some poison soup or whatever. Anything that would ruin that entertainment, I think they would get. So having subtle magic, where you slightly increase your speed or your strength or your toughness or whatever, things like that, brilliant.
Yeah, and also you've got the crowd who's a bit of a character in the game as well, so they can influence things, yeah.
Yes, yeah. I'm that mechanic was worked on with Pinnacle Entertainment themselves. We had quite a lot back and forth between three or four of their people, and that mechanic went through about five or six or seven different iterations. That took 4 to 5 months to work out. Where one thing where you drew extra cards for the crowd, and then this happened, and then that happened, and you got, and we went backwards and forwards because what we wanted was we wanted you to have almost a momentum type mechanic. So when you're winning, you keep winning, but that can get derailed. When it throws it off, then the opponent can start gathering momentum. And it's all about making best use of that momentum when you've got it.
Yeah. Well, we're looking forward to playing it, so thanks for that.
GM Screen Gladiators.
Okay, let's roll on here. Oh, and this is a six. And this is a campaign. This is a problem of our own making. We've talked about things that we're doing that have been pre-written. And this is a problem. I'll say of our own making,
Of your own making. It is a problem for me, but it's of your making.
Which is
a problem for other people, but of your making, not of our own making.
So this is the Gladiator that has started this month. So people have not been keeping up. We've got involved as like 20-odd people involved in this. So we've got five GMs and about 20-odd players who are... Once a week, Monday night is fight night.
Yeah.
And we're having an arena to have various characters. So in September, they've been creating those characters and we've had a couple of conflicts already. And I suppose the other spice in this is that the Games Masters have characters within the world.
Yeah.
And they've got, they have their meetings to determine what the next
form of
entertainment. For the people of the Empire, it's a form of entertainment, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a fight, but it's really...
a challenge.
Yeah, it's about entertainment more than anything.
Yeah. I think some of the players have kind of not grasped that yet, have they? They've kind of seen it as an outright fight.
Kill the death. Kill everything in the arena. Oh, yeah. What was the challenge again? Don't forget about that.
Yeah. So each fight has a particular victory conditions that have been created by the GMs in this council. And they're having to deal with things as well in the back, aren't they? Because...
yeah, there's a few financial issues. And,
yeah.
Trying to afford good monsters for the, you know...
yeah.
Couldn't afford a good monster for the last fight, so we had to stand in with something else.
Yeah, compromise for the bison.
The bison, yeah. Two-headed bison, but yeah. So.
Yeah.
And there's a league table, isn't there?
A league
table.
So the
players, the players all get points for the number, is it Savage Worlds we're using, isn't it?
Yeah.
So they get points for the number of raises that they get during the game. The idea being that if you get raises, it's just more impressive and the crowd likes it. So,
yeah.
And then you get points for fulfilling the victory conditions. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of competitive banter going on the Discord channel that you can participate. Yeah, yeah. And even if you're not a fighter in the game, you can bet on the result.
Bet, yeah. Not real money, guessing the revenue, or the gambling commissioner or whatever. Not real money.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to...
it's not real. It's just RPG money, silver pieces.
Yeah. I'm not the next Fred Dawn.
No. Ladbrokes.
Yeah. Fred Dawn, I'm going to make loads of money and then launder it through building property in Salford. Cut that out. What's that? Is that the...
edit that out. Illegal, your lawyers.
Yeah, lawyers. Yes, ma'am. Yes, my lord. Yes. Yeah. So how have you found it so far? Are you into it?
You've enjoyed it. I've enjoyed it, and I think last I ran one of them last night, and it was a bit of a close run thing. The first run two fights, haven't we? The first fight, I think they found that relatively easy, but last night was pretty tough. I think everyone was on two or three wounds by the end of it, which in Savage Worlds is bad. You know?
Yeah.
So it was quite a close run thing. There was a point where I thought, and I think the players thought, someone's going to buy the dust here. This is it. You know, someone's going to die. There were points where that was very close.
We're going to have player versus player probably later on.
Yeah.
It's the fighting against NPCs, but there is victory conditions, as we said. So only one person can win.
Yeah, one person can fulfill the victory condition and get extra points. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the rest of the players get points for raises.
Yeah.
You know, which was, it's kind of interesting last night because one player got 17 raises.
Yeah.
Absolutely tons of raises, you know, and one player get any.
Yes. Yeah.
But of course, fulfilling the victory condition, even if you don't get the raises, will get you extra points.
Yeah.
So
they're not getting them on damage. It's just on tasks.
No, it's just on tasks. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, let's see how it goes. I think my vision is if it is, we'll do multiple seasons of it. And
that's my vision, is it?
That's my vision. But it's containing it, isn't it? Because on paper, it seemed like a modest proposition, didn't it, to say, actually, an hour every fortnight for each GM, and then an hour a month where you're doing the council meetings, determining what we're going to do and having a bit of backroom intrigue and politics. But it's not working out quite like that, is it? Because you have to do stuff as well, haven't you, to kind of support it.
Yeah, and I suppose Savage Worlds is, we like Savage Worlds. Savage Worlds is good, but it is like a skirmish game, so you've got to set up your tokens and do the stats and do the edges and do the hindrances and do all the monsters and things and get all that in place to run it. You know, it's not like a vague theatre of the mind story game, is it? It's kind of quite a detailed combat game, really.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a fight, really.
Yeah.
Like I said, literally a skirmish, I suppose.
Yeah. And I'm learning a lot as well from, I've played Savage Worlds a lot, and one of the campaigns we're playing at the moment is Rippers, isn't it, in that kind of world of the scientific romances of the Victorian period. But I think running it, you realise how tactical you can actually be in fights.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah,
you can see how definitely there, isn't it? That you can see all these, you know, it has lots of role-playing elements and it has lots of nice little mini-games in it that are quite good. So it's quite a versatile game. But when you get into combat, you realise that, yeah, there's definitely a, that's where its starting point was. You can see that in it, can't you?
Yes.
You know,
yeah,
it's got quite detailed combat.
Let's see how that transpires.
Mm-hmm.
Got a few more weeks of that. That's good.
Roses and thorns.
Now that the season has come to an end and the fights are completed, I feel able to reflect on the Gladiator experience and put it down as a partial success. A success because it was really good fun meeting with the players once a fortnight and there was a sense of anticipation ahead of each session. As a Lannister of my ludus, I appreciated the creativities that the players brought to the fight. For instance, a character had a hindrance that they couldn't swim, and when the arena was flooded, he didn't see it as a problem. He killed one of the sharks, dragged it towards him with his trident on a chain, and he sat on it like a kayak to go across to the middle of the island. Although these were predominantly combat encounters, I enjoyed the emergence of character during the sessions. Ruthless cunning, compassionate cooperation, and relentless crowd-pleasing was on display and shaped by the players and the personalities of their characters. Thanks to the creativity of some of the members of the different ludices, Anyway, it was possible to read after-action play reports from the others. For example, in the Jamon's ludus, the Lannister who was a disgraced general, he had a poetic gladiator in training. Mardrak, the poet, provided a play report in verse. "Well done, Jamon. You won the race. But these chariots were a complete disgrace. A mess, a shame, and utter shambles. What's that? You want to hear examples? Straps broke, wheels shook, our steering broken. It's time the fearless truth was spoken. Bad luck? No, the answer's clear. A saboteur was present here." Ah, yes, the chariot race, which seemed like a good idea at the time. We did it as a token-based movement around the circuit. My experience was quite exciting and was really the start of an ongoing rivalry between Tazun, played by Doc Cowie, and Vexius, played by Steve from Orlanth Rex's Gaming Vexes. There were battles between them. At -2 on an unstable platform, as I kept being reminded, and audacious manoeuvres around the corners. The turns were really important, but it came down to token placement rather than any strategy. Have you ever been blamed as a GM? You know, mind tricks played David Blaine style. Numbers shouted out, "It's -2. No, +2. He's distracted and shaken." "No, he isn't. He's just vulnerable. Is he? I'm sure he was shaken." During the chariot racing session, and not for the last time, I felt, though my GM brain had been put through the rinser. One of the aspects that I loved about the campaign was devising the challenges for the gladiators. Last year, I revived the game world we created back in 1984 for the PBM that I ran. Racklash is the name of the continent where I set some of the adventures last year for my gaming group and a couple of conventions. The gladiatorial arena was set in the capital city of the Empire of the Ruby Sword. I did tell you that I read a lot of Moorcock when I was younger, didn't I? The Dome of the Bronze Pacator was a new arena created by an ambitious noble, Caradhrian, who I played as a Lannister of my ludus. The challenges were based on scenarios that I'd run last year. Caradhrian wanted to demonstrate the influence of the Empire on recent events, so he recreated the Battle of the Narsi, for example. The sacred tree was destroyed. In the arena, a practical prop tree was created for the gladiators to fell after a battle with recently released prisoners in costumes to represent the Narsi barbarians. Part of the pleasure
of coming up with the vignettes was the theatre of creating the adventures with substitutions in actors, because the arena couldn't afford to populate the games with the real thing. A memorable challenge was the recreation of a story from Bakar about a princeling who was so stupid that he got lost in the forest. He encountered a wise dragon who asked him riddles. The princeling gave such odd answers that the dragon ate him out of curiosity and became stupid itself. In its rage, it wandered through the forest, destroying everything in its wake. The Empire soldiers released the princeling from the belly of the dragon. In the arena, one of the apprentices from the Ludus was greased up with lard and pushed into a crocodile that had been made to look up like a dragon. A crazy hour ensued as the gladiators attempted to get the greased up boy regurgitated before he suffocated in the crocodile. I say it was a partial success, as I didn't really have the time needed to coordinate and support some of the activities around the fights. Back in the day, the Gladiators Gazette, the PBM organised by Jan McManus, aka Belzebub, gave gladiators a chance to bet on the outcome of each other's fights. I tried to run Omer's Grab's betting book, but in reality, it didn't really get off the ground. It needed a bit more coordination to encourage the participants to engage more. The council meetings didn't really happen either. A scheduling conflict meant that we only actually met once. Instead, we organised the sessions in a text chat. The political machinations are the bit that I found interesting about the TV series Spartacus and the original PBM. In the end, it was all about the fights and the leaderboard. And there's an article in the latest edition of Senate, the magazine about board games. If you haven't seen it, then try to get hold of it, as it's a great magazine. It's got some good quality reviews in it, and it looks brilliant. But the article talks about the role of competition. Play fighting, there are times when the teeth are shown and it starts to bite. And player-on-player combat in RPGs feels really uncomfortable. Although most of the challenges put to the gladiators against NPC opponents, they were trying to win. The final battle was more or less a straight fight. It just didn't feel right. All the appropriate safety tools and consent was in place, but it was uncomfortable when a player struck another player with a sword so hard that they were bleeding out. This was pitched as the first season. Will there be another? Possibly, but I'd do it differently. I would lean into some of the subsystems within Savage Worlds. Take the chariot race, for instance. That would have worked better using the abstracted but more narrative chase rules, because it would have got rid of the discussion around token placement and recreated the sensations of a chase with mishaps and successes without being overly concerned with the minutiae of actions. Also, in the next version, it'll need more role-playing element and reflect the stuff that I enjoyed about the Spartacus TV series. No, you're wrong. Not more nudity. There's quite enough of that. No, it was the backroom deals and the social climbing that needed to be recreated. The fights could be resolved using the quick encounter rules in the same way that the series does, in a way. The set pieces in slow-mo, blood-splattered sequences that are over reasonably quickly. The emphasis should be on developing the status of the characters rather than gaming the edges to maximise actions and potential raises. A partial success. Nevertheless, an achievement to have an online game with so many participants. Another project fulfilled. Another obsession realised. Or not quite.
Magnus Seater on RPG writing.
Well, it's a thing that it's been very interesting to see the That's also one of the reasons why I was contacted to write this book, since I've been writing for role-playing games since 1989. I mentioned that. And I've been writing for writing for all versions of Dragon, all publishers of Dragonbane. And I've written for Cubicle 7, I've written for Telsorian Games, I've written for Game Designers Workshop, short pieces, not very big things, except for Mutant Chronicles, the first version of the role-playing game that I wrote for Target Games. And I also wrote The Bitter Reach for Free League, and I've written some other stuff. But I when I started in 1982, the hobby of role-playing games appealed to me because it was a creationist, not a creationist, but a creator's hobby. Like you created your own adventures, you created your own monsters, you wrote stuff, and instead of just writing something and sending it to someone and hoping someone will publish it or read it, because I've always been a writer, I could write something and I could go to my friends and we would play it and they would say, this is cool and this is cool. And then I started writing for conventions and assembled a team of game masters who went to conventions playing Cyberpunk 2020. And that was hugely popular in Sweden. And as I grew writing for conventions, because you have to, when you take the step out from writing for yourself into writing for someone else, you have to have a lot more structure in your games. So then I started sending out manuscripts, suggestions to Telsorian Games, for example, and they accepted it. And then to Target Games, who published the Dragonbane at the time, and Mutant and Cult and stuff like that. So a very hectic period, 89 to 94, I worked on Dragonbane, Cult, and I wrote Mutant Chronicles. Mm-hmm. And learned to know these people. And then the role-playing game sort of waned in Sweden for a while, and they started picking up again in 2000. And by coincidence, I happened to work with one of the illustrators that has been hugely influential in role-playing games in Sweden, which is a guy called Peter Bergting. He's after this, he's grown into a prolific comic creator. Working with Dark Horse Comics and a lot of other things. But I started a web company together with him, and we got the contact with some people who said, well, we want to talk about Peter writing for us. Can we come up and just have a talk? And I'm like, well, that's cool. I worked for Target Games, so I can also maybe help you. So I started to know the Riot Minds people who created Trudvang, and that was sort of like my return into starting to getting to know people. I wrote little for them, and some people I had met through the conventions started doing the Mutant, not the Mutant Year Zero, but the iteration before that, which is called the Heirs of the Apocalypse, which was the Iron Ring, which is now a part of Free League. Mm-hmm. So I knew them, and then I started getting to know the people at Helmgast who are doing Ian, which is the major Swedish role-playing game, which hasn't been translated. But they also publish, for example, Troubleshooters, which is a fabulous game. And I sort of stayed in the community, writing stuff here and writing stuff there, and learning to know people, and that sort of tied everything together for me. And I realized that we were much more a closely knit community of creators who wanted the same thing. Basically, during the early 2000s, we still had this mentality of, "Well, I have this game is my game, and your game sucks," but that's almost gone here in Sweden now. And people started to learn to know each other and started to cooperate. Well, we sort of share experiences. And then also I started being involved in one of the Swedish internet forums, which is called Rollspel.nu, RPG.nu, basically. And today I run that, and it's not a huge community, but people have been there since 2000 or something. So 25 years together as friends on the internet, arguing and shouting and screaming and sometimes agreeing with each other, has also sort of like helped us to get to know each other within the community. I've been writing games since 1984. I kind of joke. The first thing I wrote for the first iteration of Dragonbane was a short random table about what kind of fish you could pull up of a creek, and then I wrote some stats for snakes. That was my start, and after that I sort of just hammered away at the typewriter writing the short adventures for my friends before I sort of started sending out things. And that's also why I describe myself as much as a fan as a creator. And I always try to make sure that I remember that when I meet other role-playing gamers. My strongest skill is structure, being able to write so that people can read what I write. And that was not a very strong representation of that among the authors at the time. So I would send it to Target Games and they would like, okay, this is great. That's printed. Today, there are so many talented role-playing game writers, Free League, Helmgast, other companies, but also fans who create things they put up for free on the internet, that I think that it would be a lot more difficult for me today to sort of break through and become an established role-playing writer, because it is so much easier to get your stuff published. You can publish it yourself and you can reach out to people and talk to them and everything. But also the amount of talent creating enormously cool stuff out there today is so much larger than it was when I was young and started breaking into this. For example, 4 or 5 years ago, something came out of Sweden that was like, is this possible? Is this legal? Are you allowed to do this? And that was Mörkborg. And suddenly something exploded onto the scene that was like, wow, this is real creativity. What I'm doing, writing sort of quaint, cute adventures for Dragonbane, which are, playable, but they're nothing to write home about when it comes to creativity or breaking new ground and stuff like that. But, fairly popular. And then suddenly something like Mörkborg comes along, and it's insane.
Yeah.
On so many levels.
And what it does, it really taps into that DIY culture, doesn't it, role-playing games. It's kind of built on that, and that's what's so remarkable about it, really.
It is, and it's also a testament of the something that Free League has also moved towards. It's a sort of testament of letting your creation go. They have Mörkborg has a very generous license. And so they say, you can do whatever, just don't be a Nazi. but apart from that, you can do that. And I think that's quite reasonable, actually. So there are so much stuff for Mörkborg out there, and Cyborg, of course, as well. And I think that Free League sort of looked at that. And they did have a license for Forbidden Lands, or the Year Zero license, but that was not much used. But then they did the Dragonbane license, which is much more permissive. Mm-hmm. And we've seen now it exploding, the amount of material that that's put out for Dragonbane, not just in Sweden but also internationally, has exploded. There's so much stuff being put out of so high quality that I'm totally blown away by it. Mm-hmm. And the fans are as much as part of the game creation as the writers. That's Johan Nord, who was a designer for Mörkborg. He says that he hates the fans, but he means that he hates the separation of game creator and fan, because he's not comfortable with there being fans who sort of like, Johan and Pelle, they did this thing, and they're so good. He's like, we did this thing, and now you go and do your thing and send it to us or publish it yourself. Don't be a fan, be a part of the community and be a part of the creation of this huge gaming experience together. We don't need to sort of separate, we don't need to have different levels of stardom within the role-playing game community, because we are a niche hobby, and a fan today can be the next Merc Boy, basically. So if the old geezers like us, if we encourage the young people to do that, they will create much better stuff than we ever did. But we need to be open to encouraging them to do that, and not be gatekeepers. We just need to, oh, you can do cool stuff. Let's try this. Oh, this looks Merc Boy. I don't really understand what's going on here, but let me try it and see what happens.
Last year, we went to Stockholm, and I was really surprised. Oh, it was a surprise, but there's a real developed sense of a geek culture over there. You know, the shops there are incredible. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, it's also a question of Swedish role playing gamers growing out of the science fiction fandom and the Tolkien fandom. Mm. So a lot of the early creators knew each other through the Tolkien fandom and the science fiction fandom, and that's also two fandoms that are really close to the close to our hearts. And I've been a part of the science fiction fan. I've read more science fiction during my life than I have read fantasy, actually. So that, which is why I started writing for cyberpunk genre, and I wrote Moon Chronicles and stuff like that. But still, I come back to fantasy because it's fantasy, and fantasy is cool. But the SF fandom, sort of like we could tag along with those people, the Tolkien fandom as well. Like we could sort of like grow from there. They would know each other, and we would sort of like come in through the role playing game back door. It was amazing seeing people sort of like just nerding out, dressing up as characters and having names like the people in the Tolkien world. And even though we didn't want to do that, we saw someone who really engaged in their geeky interests in the geeky hobby, and that encouraged us to, oh, we can do this, but we can engage in our version of the geeky hobby. And also from the SF fandom that grew a bookshop, which is called the Science Fiction Bookstore, SF Bokhandeln, which has always been an important part of getting science fiction literature in Sweden, and since some of the people writing the most influential role-playing game products worked or were engaged in that company, they would also carry role-playing games. So it has always been possible to get role-playing games through one or two shops. Even if it was a downturn during the end of the 90s, you could always get role-playing games from the science fiction bookstore. And they were knowledgeable because they were the people who made or had made the games. So the geek culture, we don't exist, gamers don't exist in a bubble in Sweden, at least. It's not as if we are the gamers, but we have the SF fandom people, we have the Tolkien. I don't know what a Tolkien fandom is, what they do now, but they're probably as vibrant as ever. But we have the SF fandom, we have the Tolkien fandom, we have the fantasy literature, we have the anime people, we have the LARPers, of course, are a big part of this as well. I'm not a LARPer, I'm a tabletop role-playing gamer. So it's easy for me to forget about them, but they carried the role-playing game hobby for a long while in Sweden because they were engaged, and that's a maker culture. They put together fantastic arrangements, but they also do chainmail and or they knit things. Or I spoke to someone the other week who had woven her own silk shawl
and leatherwork as well.
Great. Exactly, leatherwork. Yeah, and I also met someone who I just realized that he's a weaponsmith. He's an armorer, so he's a weaponsmith basically. So he makes armor, and he had one on display at the Free League arrangement the other week, where he had made a helmet for a duck. that people could wear and stuff like that. And the maker culture of role playing games, I think, is what makes this hobby such a powerful hobby, because it's not a question of this is this person who has written something, and then the rest of us just take part of that. And wow, this was a good written, well written adventure and stuff like that. It's like I did a convention arrangement for Free League 2 years ago at one of our larger conventions, and sent out the adventure, and I met up with the game masters, and there was this game master came up and she said that, well, this is the first time I'm game mastering at a convention. I'm really nervous, but I've made this, and she had built a diorama of the adventure place, the site of the adventure, so she just put it on the table and had minis, and people would walk around in, and I'm like, are you insane? Have you done this? How long did this take? Oh, 4 or 5 hours, maybe, something like that. I'm like, wow, this is so cool. And that mentality is what really brings energy to me as well now, that people are using, well, role-playing games can be seen as a very text-heavy hobby, but it's also a very tactile hobby. And people are doing a lot of tactile things with minis or terrain, dice towers, stuff that enhances the play experience, not just endless Rollmaster tables for everything. I love Rollmaster, or at least I loved it. We played it for years and years. But today it's like maybe not that many tables. We can do stuff other ways instead, basically. Oh, ramble.
Yeah. Well, that was great. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
There isn't another bit.
Thanks to Graham and Magnus for the interviews. And thanks to the patrons who make all of this possible by covering our expenses and encouraging us to continue. If you like this dossier and want to hear more of them, you can listen to the previous ones over at Patreon. As a patron, we organise Grog Meet in Manchester and 2 online conventions every year, and you'll be the first to find out about them. There's a book club every month, a film watch along most weeks, and we also run online one-shots with me and Blythe, usually 6 a year, and as a patron, you can be part of that. There's a lively but not overbearing Discord that you can be part of and hear of the other projects like the Grogvine and another Grogzine, possibly, and lots of other stuff like the Gladiator event. It's a chance to be part of an RPG community, and if you've been away from role-playing for a while and fancy coming back, you'll find it helpful, supportive, to help you get you started. At the time of recording, December 2025, it's still time for you to promote or review the Grognard Files for a chance to win Magnus's book, Outside the Box, How Sweden Conquered the World of RPGs. All you need to do is let me know where you've shared or written about the Grognard Files, and I will put you into the hat to draw from a chance to win a copy of the book. Okay, as I say, I'm recording this in December, so this is a bit of an end-of-year treat for you. There'll be another Grognard Files coming out this month, you know, a proper episode. But if you're listening to this, it comes out. It's around Christmas time, so I hope you have a great celebration. Or however you celebrate the end of the year, I hope you have a good time. Sometimes this time of the year can be difficult for people, and if that applies to you, I do hope that you find some peace. So until next time, adios, amigos.